From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we elicit two views on the fallout from the U.S. targeted killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani on January 2nd and Iran's retaliation 6 days later. Tehran fired more than a dozen ballistic missiles at two Iraqi air bases that house U.S. troops. First, we'll talk with Middle East expert Ellen Lapson. She's director of the Master's in International Security degree program at the School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Professor Lapson is no stranger to these VOA microphones. We spoke with her just last November in the wake of the anti-government demonstrations in Iraq. Prior to her current post, Ellen served in numerous senior national security positions within the U.S. government. She was also president and CEO of the Stimson Center, a prestigious think tank here in Washington. And Ellen Lapson joins us by phone from her office in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Ellen Lapson, let me get you to react to the targeted killing of General Qasem Soleimani. From what we know, what do you make of this strike on the general and the manner in which it was undertaken without consultation with Congress nor our NATO allies? Do you think it was justifiable?
Well, I think that Soleimani was clearly a tremendous challenge to American national security officials. He was the mastermind, had a regional strategy, was very much promoting Iran's expanding influence in the region, and he was not at all hesitant to target American official facilities and military officers as part of his overall strategy. So he was an enemy of the United States, there's no doubt, but I think there will be a lot of after-action thinking and analysis as to how did we net out the costs and benefits of going after a serving official of a sovereign state. I think we use the word terrorist very sloppily in this case because he was a commander of forces that used non-conventional force. We very easily call him a terrorist, but this is not exactly the same thing as attacking a member of a non-government organization like Hezbollah or Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State. So there are consequences. There are political ramifications. There are regional insecurities that result from this kind of very dramatic and unexpected action. So I think it adds turbulence to the region. The only good news is that we seem to be coming out of the most dangerous part of the cycle of U.S.-Iran relations right now, and perhaps both parties are now willing to step back a little bit.
Given the retaliation by Iran, it wasn't as devastating as some may have thought.
And I think we're actually quite curious now of whether Iran intentionally avoided causing any casualties. I think the Iranians know well that a trigger for President Trump is a killing or wounding of any individual American citizen. And did they intentionally target these missiles to sort of be on the base but not where soldiers were present? So it's quite a curiosity. Did the Iranians intentionally use perhaps less lethal systems, and did they target them to avoid casualties?
And speaking of the costs and benefits of this targeted killing, let's look at the impact on U.S. relations with Iraq, because many analysts are now saying with this, what some characterize as a reckless move, the targeted killing of Soleimani, that in a sense the United States has ceded Iraq to Iran, has put our soldiers and our allies at greater risk, and even given the so-called Islamic State a reprieve. And it's, in a sense, united what was a divided Iran, given the protests against the government and even the anti-government protests in Iraq, which were also targeting Iran's influence. Now everybody's united against the United States.
So I do think, you know, you've identified several of the ways in which the decision to go after Soleimani appears to have been done somewhat impulsively and without carefully vetting all the likely or even remotely likely reactions and secondary effects. So for sure, poor Iraq has become an even more fragile state. And it's the second big historical cycle where the United States has done something in the region thinking it would somehow weaken Iran, promote democratic transitions in the Arab world. And in fact, the real outcome is to give Iran more influence in the region. The first time was toppling Saddam Hussein, bringing about Shia majority government in Iraq, which clearly created a wonderful opportunity for Iran to have more influence in that country. This time, as you said, not only will, at least in the short run, unify Iranians, because it always provokes a kind of patriotism when these things happen, but the violation of Iraqi sovereignty is really quite breathtaking. And in theory, the Americans owe something to Iraq. I mean, we have been the source of the deconstructing of the Iraqi state and the incomplete reconstruction of a new political system there. And so I personally think that we have both a political and moral obligation to still be invested in the stability and sovereignty and independence of Iraq. The killing on Iraqi soil of a third country official seems to me to be quite a violation of Iraqi sovereignty. And we're seeing Iraq's leaders, the prime minister, the president, and other politicians, really struggling to command the authority that their positions should impose on them. And we see a country where the officials of the country are kind of scrambling to, you know, assert the authority that, in theory, they should have.
With respect to the parliament's vote to have the troops leave, that is, U.S. troops, where do you think this is going? And wouldn't that be definitely to the detriment of the United States and its strategic interests if, in fact, the government requires that the U.S. troops leave? And then there's, of course, the question of, you know, whether the United States sent a letter saying that they would be leaving and then retracted that. It's all very confusing. And as a former government official, I'd like to get your view on that.
Well, so I would say that from the first Gulf War of President George H.W. Bush, there's a very interesting pattern here of American troops deploying to the region, but only when they are invited or permitted by the host country, and then leaving when their mission is over. So there's nothing wrong, in theory, with saying our work is done, we can go home now, and it was never our intention to have permanent bases, you know, these days. I mean, in the sort of late 20th and early 21st century, the sort of political expectation is that you don't have permanent bases and you don't kind of occupy or have some kind of neo-colonial presence in a country. So we went into Saudi Arabia in 1990, we left in 91. So there is a pattern here of you only want to be in country at the request and with the permission of the host country. So in 2011, the Obama administration, when the agreement that was negotiated by the George W. Bush administration expired, we had no legal basis to keep our troops in Iraq, and we left. We came home. Islamic State took advantage of the vacuum that was created, and lo and behold, we go back in 2014. This time, you know, it's not beyond the imagination that President Trump's desire to remove troops from the Middle East was a legitimate thing that might, in fact, conform with the desire of the people in the region. But to be kicked out because we did something that so deeply displeased a sovereign Arab state is a very awkward and embarrassing way for U.S. forces to leave. But I think this story is not over yet. As far as I know, it was a non-automatically obligatory resolution on the part of the Iraqi parliament. Significant players in the Iraq landscape of political figures don't want us to leave. So I think we're at the beginning of a negotiating process. It is for sure true that one of the outcomes may be that both parties agree the U.S. forces should be drawn down over a timetable to be determined, and maybe there would be some residual security presence that would remain, a training mission, a counterterrorism mission, etc. But I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to say that our troops are only there when they have a mission to perform, and when that mission is over, they can come home.
Your point is well taken. What about the fight against the so-called Islamic State? Where does this leave that fight, that is, the killing of Soleimani? What does it do to fighting against the so-called Islamic State, which isn't completely defeated and which may take some comfort from this current action?
I think the real potential source of violence in the near term may not be the reconstitution of the Islamic State, but would be the domestic frictions among the different armed groups inside Iraq. So you've got the Shia militia that were supposed to be totally integrated into the Iraqi national security forces, and clearly they are still behaving in a quasi-independent way. So you've got Sunni and Kurdish forces that have sort of restricted geographic responsibilities. You still don't have a competent and coherent Iraqi national security system. And sure, you can throw the Islamic State into that mix, but I don't think today the Islamic State is necessarily the most lethal threat. They could become that. But again, if we assume that Iran has more power on the ground in Iraq today than we do, Iran also can't stand the Islamic State. And the one irony of this whole sad story is that, you know, there had been a rare opportunity for U.S.-Iran cooperation in the fight against the Islamic State between 2014 and 2017.
Indeed. And are you concerned about the state of the protests? In fact, if you could tell us, what is the state of the anti-government protests in Iraq now in the wake of this killing? There were some promising, in a sense, one could say promising movement that is on the behalf of the protesters wanting greater democracy, greater transparency, less corruption. Where does that leave these protests?
Well, I think the grievances that are not driven purely by sectarian identity or by, you know, regional differences in Iraq, I think those grievances were economic and political and are really part of this story of the weakening of the legitimacy of the Iraqi officials, state actors. So, to the best of my knowledge, the protesters may be quiet right now because the country is in a little bit of a state of shock, but those grievances are quite real and we'll certainly be hearing from them again. But remember that the pro-Iranian militias were doing their own thing. They were doing their own protests. So you've got one group that is inclined to be anti-American and other groups that seem to be expressing resentment of Iran's role in Iraq. We can't oversimplify this story. It's not a one-dimensional story. It has many different dimensions to it.
Are you concerned that Russia may step into the vacuum? There are rumors that they may even offer to train Iraqi troops should the United States leave. And isn't that negative for the region, again, seeing the rise of Russia in Syria and elsewhere in the region, you know, dwarfing the United States?
Well, I don't think they dwarf the United States. I don't think they'll have the capability to dwarf the United States for many, many years to come. They are playing a very active diplomatic role, and quite frankly, that's what's kind of playing to their strengths right now, that they talk to both Iran and Israel. They talk to the U.S. and the Syrians. They talk to the Turks. I mean, just this week I've seen reference to Putin and Erdogan together calling for a de-escalation between the U.S. and Iran. So they've really benefited by offering their diplomatic services. It doesn't mean in any respect that they could replace the much more concrete security role that the United States has played for so many years. Yes, the Russians can train limited numbers of security forces, but I'm not sure that Iraq is willing to turn the clock back and go to the days when they were a Soviet client. I think that's quite far away from where we are today. But diplomatic leadership, yes. And does that make the United States look weaker? Yes.
And Alan Lapson, let's go back to the United States and the way in which the president made this decision without consulting Congress, and now Congress is being briefed on what was supposed to be an imminent threat. Now, some members are saying that, from what they've heard, that they are not persuaded about the evidence of any imminence of the threat or that was anything compelling that would justify this targeted killing of such an important general in Iran. And then, therefore, what about the role of Congress? Does that concern you that they were not consulted, that the so-called Gang of Eight were not consulted about this strike?
Yes, I think in the best of worlds, the White House should voluntarily want to keep senior political figures from the legislative branch informed, even if they're not legally obliged to do so. And so it certainly would have been smarter, but there's also enough of a track record that says if we brief Congress, it leaks, and then, you know, the operational security is compromised. So I understand both sides of the argument that sometimes the executive branch wants to hold on to operational security and then, you know, immediately thereafter say, here's what was at stake and here's why we did it. Pompeo's press conference this week was not very compelling in terms of that there was some very specific reason why this threshold had been crossed that required this very, very quick decision. Target of opportunity. And remember, Soleimani didn't hide. He strutted around the region as a public persona. He did not go in and out in secretive ways, so he wasn't that hard to find. But yes, the system works better when the executive branch and the Congress have enough mutual respect that they want to keep each other informed and that they trust each other. I don't know whether legally the president necessarily did anything wrong. The House is now saying that they will try to finally retire the authorization for the use of military force that we've had in effect since 9/11, that for sure should be closed down, and that any new military action should require a fresh legislative justification.
And finally, as we close, Ellen Labson, given your previous high-level positions in the U.S. government, how do you think the U.S. could have responded to strikes on U.S. targets by Iran, shipping in the Straits of Hormuz, and the killing of the contractor that in part precipitated this escalation? Couldn't there have been a different, less costly action short of this targeted assassination? How do you see the U.S.-Iranian relationship?
Well, first, I think we have underutilized diplomacy. The administration sends very kind of mixed signals that, oh, we want peace, we want to talk, but then they use language that is very harsh and that is very agitating to the Iranians, where the Iranians for sure feel that the United States is very hostile to them and that the United States is also stronger and bigger and more powerful than they are. So it's an asymmetric situation. And so I think we've underutilized diplomacy. We may have overused sanctions. But on the military side, the truth is deterrence has eroded in the region. It used to be that the steadiness and the quiet strength of our military presence in the region really did deter Iran. When we talk so openly about we really don't want to be there, we want to come home, why don't other people spend their money, why is it always us who has to spend, we have weakened our deterrent capability vis-a-vis Iran for several years now, and now we're living with the consequences of it.
Ellen Labson is a former senior U.S. national security official, currently director of the Masters in International Security degree program at the School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Ellen Labson, thank you so much for your time and keen insights.
Thank you, Carol.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. We're discussing the U.S.-Iran crisis in the wake of the U.S. targeted killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iran's retaliation. My guests are Ellen Labson, Middle East expert at George Mason University, from whom you just heard. After the break, we will talk with Mara Carlin, Director of Strategic Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies here in Washington. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. Well, here's a shout out to our valued Facebook fan, Omid Mohammadi from Kabul, Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Now we turn to Mara Carlin, Director of Strategic Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. She has served in national security roles for five U.S. Secretaries of Defense, advising on policies for the Middle East, Europe, and Asia. Mara Carlin, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Many members of Congress are not satisfied with the Trump administration's briefing with regard to the strike against Qasem Soleimani. Many are saying on both sides of the aisle that it didn't sound like Qasem Soleimani posed an imminent threat, which would have perhaps justified the drastic action of killing the general And of course, no matter how anathema he is to the United States, he was considered among the top echelon in the Iranian government. What's your take on the wisdom of this action based on the latest briefing from the White House?
We can all agree that Qasem Soleimani was a horrific man for U.S. national security interests, particularly over the last two decades. There's really no debate about that. However, where there's a lot of genuine debate is why was he killed, when he was killed, and where he was killed. And unfortunately, the Trump administration has just given a wide range of contradictory and convoluted responses to that question. And so I'm deeply sympathetic to members of Congress and, frankly, to the American people who just don't feel like there's an understanding or an appreciation as to why this happened now. Previous administrations have considered this action, chose not to do so. And I think, particularly in a classified hearing with key members of Congress, there's a valid, genuine expectation explaining why this happened, when it happened.
And what about the lack of congressional consultation prior to the strike? In other words, even if the president had the constitutional authority to target Qasem Soleimani and kill him, the fact that he failed to inform the leaders of the House and Senate, particularly top Democrats, particularly if they had such imminent information, does that concern you?
It is far from ideal, and I find it rather disconcerting. There's a reason we have a system of checks and balances. But to be frank, what only exacerbates this dynamic is the inability for the administration to explain to members of Congress in a satisfactory manner after the strike why it happened. We're now a week plus outside of when this strike happened, and I think the various folks watching it, trying to understand it, can spin a multitude of different stories as to why it happened and when it did. So members of Congress are understandably frustrated, particularly many of the most senior members of Congress, frustrated that they don't have an understanding of why this happened, but moreover, can't figure out why a week later they still don't have these answers.
Well, let me get your reaction to President Trump's speech after Iran's retaliation on two Iraqi military bases that housed U.S. military personnel. Thank God no injuries, or rather no deaths were reported, and the damage was fairly contained. Mr. Trump said that he would impose additional economic sanctions on Iran, but did not call for any additional military action in response to Tehran's missile attacks at those bases. Now, he implies that the United States is better off since this strike. Do you think that the United States is safer having taken out General Soleimani, from your understanding of the region? Has it enhanced U.S. leverage and influence in the region against Iran and its nefarious regional activities?
So the decision to kill Qasem Soleimani is a monumental one. It is actually not possible, I think, to overstate how significant it is. Easily the most notable killing in the Middle East, the most notable U.S. action in the Middle East for at least a decade, if not longer. So the U.S. decision to do it, which, again, is still a little bit unclear, involved climbing up the escalation ladder and skipping tens of rungs while doing so. There didn't appear to be much of a U.S. effort to, say, restrict the travel of Qasem Soleimani, to engage the Iraqis, restrict his travel per U.N. Security Council resolutions. So it seemed as though there were other steps the U.S. could have taken short of this. Again, though, I'm saying that without knowledge of what sort of imminence of a threat, because we haven't really seen that evidence, and we also haven't seen an event happen. And while the initial, and I hasten to emphasize, initial Iranian response was to attack Iraqi bases, and yes, it's a miracle that there were no American lives lost. That may have been due to a multitude of reasons. You know, playing with missiles is not playing with Legos. This easily could have turned out differently. So while on one level I was heartened that the president seemed to strike a more moderate tone, I suspect the confusion that has emanated from that speech, where he effectively is still fundamentally looking for a new regime in Iran, at least based on his actions, I suspect that that only will allow the sort of long-term challenge to continue.
But with regard to being safer or not, and with regard to enhancing U.S. influence in the region, do you think this strike helped or hurt U.S. leverage?
I cannot see how this helped U.S. leverage. The U.S.-Iraqi relationship is in tatters. No doubt Qasem Soleimani is smiling from his grave that the Iraqi parliament wants to push out the U.S. military, which was obviously an aspiration of his. The U.S. is severely divided from its European allies right now. The U.S. has actually just managed to get deeper and deeper into a region, sending thousands and thousands of new troops there over the last few weeks and months, and is not able to actually deal with the geopolitical, strategic level threat that is posed by China. So if we were safer now, then why is the region so high on the priority list again? Why are we sending thousands and thousands more troops? Why are we putting alerts out to U.S. embassies around the world? I'm not exactly sure I can understand that argument.
And with regard to the Iran nuclear deal, of course, the United States unilaterally pulled out of that deal in May 2018. And, of course, that's when it seems like tensions really ratcheted up between the United States and Iran, leading up to this tit-for-tat escalation and this killing of Soleimani and, of course, Iran's retaliation. Do you see the U.S. pulling out of that deal, even if the intent was to get a better deal, which we haven't gotten one so far? Do you see that as one of the root causes of where we are today?
I think it was fundamentally unhelpful, particularly because it has broken the U.S. off from its allies. And frankly, the U.S.'s comparative advantage, and that's not just vis-a-vis Iran, but also vis-a-vis China, vis-a-vis Russia, is its unparalleled network of allies and partners. And so by pulling out of the deal the way that the president did, failing to use deft diplomacy to try to really consider other options in a meaningful way, the U.S. in many ways has been increasingly standing alone. That does not work to our advantage. It also doesn't work to the advantage of those who seek a more stable global security order.
Now, of course, President Trump did, like you say, strike a more moderate or less bellicose tone in his address after Iran's retaliation. And some are wondering if this is the time for some kind of an off-ramp, a moment to regroup and look for some kind of a diplomatic negotiation. Do you see a possibility for the United States and Iran breaking out of this cycle of confrontation and revenge at this point?
Predictions are hard to make, particularly with this team, particularly about the future. That said, there has been, as far as I can tell, no real steps in the last few days by the administration to try to meaningfully engage rather than just criticize our close allies and partners around the world about why this happened and what possible permutations of a policy going forward might look like. So it's hard to see how this will actually play into some sort of off-ramp. I don't really see the evidence that that will be the case. If it were, we would have U.S. ambassadors around the world trying to engage their counterparts, trying to look at what the permutations of some sort of kind of near-term cooling down of tensions, initial steps of reconciliation might look like, and that's just not the case.
So, Mara Carlin, as we close, now that the United States has taken out Qasem Soleimani and Iran has retaliated, notwithstanding the fact that they've talked about that they're not responsible for any of their proxy militias in the region and what they might do, are we back to square one? Are we back to where we were? Are things, you know, back to normal? Or how do you see going forward?
I don't see how we can get back to the status quo ante. The U.S. has set an entirely new bar by killing one of the most influential Iranian military leaders, someone who was very close to the supreme leader of Iran. So what we saw was a near-term response, a pretty nicely calibrated one, sprinkled with more than a little bit of luck, I suspect. But this is not the end of the story. This may merely be the end of the beginning of the story. The Iranians, if you look at efforts that they have taken to retaliate following attacks either against them or against key proxy leaders like Hezbollah leaders, they may take their time to respond. They may do so somewhere far from the region. It's all entirely plausible. So as I noted, I really think we've seen perhaps at best the end of the beginning, but unfortunately we are in a spiral that is only going to get uglier.
Maura Carlin is Director of Strategic Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Maura, thank you very much for your keen insights.
Thank you for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Our engineers were Robert Lewis and Wojtek Zorniak. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.